Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, today I'm bringing you a conversation I had with novelist Casey Barrett. Casey's a Canadian Olympian. He's the co-founder and co-CEO of Imagine Swimming, New York City's largest learn-to-swim school. He's won 3 Emmy Awards and 1 Peabody Award for his depth of work on NBC's broadcasts of the Olympics. His debut novel, Underwater, was nominated for a 2018 Seamus Award. And today we're talking about his latest novel, just come out. It's called The Tower of Songs, a Duck Dolly novel. And this is the 3rd in the Duck Dolly series. Here's my conversation with Casey Barrett. So, Casey, let's begin with a short synopsis of the story, The Tower of Songs, the action begins in a sky-high apartment. It's on Billionaire's Row in Manhattan. We learn in the prologue that hedge funder Danny Soto is abducted. Take it away from there for us, would you?
Yes, he's not just abducted. He is drugged and taken out in full view of security cameras out the front door of his building. And Soto is a billionaire hedge funder who happens to live at the highest residential apartment in the world. They're currently the highest. And he is caught on video. His family is told to tell no one, but his 17-year-old precocious and rather entitled daughter doesn't quite know what that means, and instead seeks out my protagonist or anti-hero, Duck Dolly. And she seeks him out not necessarily because she thinks he's the best man for the job, and not even close. She seeks him out more because she sees him as an expendable alternative to silence. And she's not too concerned whether he dies trying, but she can't resist doing something and acting when she knows her father's been taken and no one else will do anything.
Right. So this is a thriller, but there are lots of different kinds of thrillers, psychological suspense. And I kind of would put this in the suspense category. Is that where you would put it if you had to?
I would. I mean, I think the distinctions between thriller and crime novels and mystery novels are sometimes rather arbitrary, and I think the good ones try to do elements of all of them, but I tend to think of it as a pure crime novel because it does center around an investigation and an unlicensed private investigator trying to track down a central mystery that appears in the opening pages.
And so as a writer, what is it that interests you and draws you to writing about crime stories?
Well, to me, every novel, even ones categorized as the traditional literary novel, my favorites always center around a central mystery or a crime. I was reading recently a fellow writer describing The Great Gatsby as the ultimate crime novel, which I fully agree with. It's essentially about a rich and dubious gangster and a murder. So from that lens, I think the great stories are really propelled by a central crime or a central mystery, and then we tend to assign novels to genres for our own reasons, but the great stories tend to be centered around great crimes.
Right. So The Tower of Songs is the 3rd in the Duck Dolly series, and so we need to let listeners know who Duck Dolly is. He's quite an interesting character. He's a former rich kid, he's a felon, a swimmer. He works in New York City. He's described as an irreverent badass who admits he's a screw-up. He's also described as the most damaged anti-hero you'd never want to meet in a dark corner of New York City. So talk to us a little bit about Duck and how you developed that character.
Sure. That's a kind description, the way you just described him. He's certainly not a good influence to anyone around him. But I like to think of him as a son of a Madoff-type character. He grew up, as you note, quite wealthy until early adolescence when his father's fortune emerged, was built on all fraud, and his father went away to life in prison, and Duck spent the rest of his upbringing essentially in urban exile, kind of banished from the Upper East to the Lower East Side, where he went from having everything to really having, not only having nothing, but having a disgraced name, And that led to not only quite a bit of resentment and quite a bit of rebellion, but also ultimately led him to prison and also led him to quite a few bad habits, pain pills and drinking being his primary bad habits. But as we open the third book, he's clean off those and is experimenting with the, quote, weed cure, meaning he is forsworn all vices except the pot.
Right. So the most interesting characters are, of course, flawed. Even if they're like a superhero, they've all got some flaw there to make them, you know, somewhat human. Why did you want to make him so damaged?
He struck me as I don't necessarily think of him as so damaged. He strikes me as his response to his circumstances as just being particularly unlucky. And the way he responds to such a horrible twist of fate at an impressionable age, I think his responses are rather realistic in my head. But I think it also makes him relatable to characters when they approach, like Layla Soto, the 17-year-old daughter who approaches. And Duck's smart enough to know that this is not a case that he has any expertise or really any talent to solve, but he takes it because he can relate to other damaged characters, particularly kids that are an impressionable age who are in the midst of family trauma. And it doesn't matter how much wealth you have around you, if you're in the midst of family trauma, you know, that's a great equalizer and a great source of empathy for everybody, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So you also bring back a character from previous book, Cassandra Kimball, who he kind of severed his relationship with her, I gathered. Tell us a little bit about her, because she's an interesting character too.
she really is, I guess, admittedly my favorite character that I write. She has an alternative day job, so to speak. She works as a dominatrix when she's not helping Duck with his investigations. And I don't mean that to be a sensationalistic day job at all. I wanted a very strong, confident character and someone that was smarter and stronger than Duck in a very very realistic way. And honestly, the inspiration goes back to, when I was a kid, my favorite series was Encyclopedia Brown. And the character Sally Kimball was his sidekick, who was stronger and smarter and braver and kind of stuck up for Encyclopedia. So that's kind of my nod to my favorite reading experience as a kid, was creating Cassandra Kimball in Sally Kimball's likeness with a little bit of an alternative twist to it.
Oh, interesting. And so often writers use a little bit of a friend's traits or their own traits. Any of you in any of the characters in this book?
Well, certainly not ones I'll admit.
I was going to ask you directly, do you relate to Duck Dolly?
it creates some interesting conversations at school, particularly when parents read my books and then ask my wife at pickup about certain characters, and so led to a bit of embarrassment where she's quick to say it is fiction and no, he's not Duck and Noah.
Yeah, people do like to look for it, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. To keep a little mystery in people.
Yes. So I want to just talk a little bit about your former life as an Olympic swimmer, because it does play into this story. The water and swimming is a theme in this book. You were a former Olympic swimmer. A lot of discipline goes into... I used to be a competitive swimmer, but nowhere near at that level. It takes a lot of work and a lot of discipline. And I'm wondering if... was that good grounding for you when you're writing a book? Because that too requires a certain amount of discipline.
Yeah, I'm always kind of baffled why there aren't more parallels between swimmers and writers. Because to me, it's such a natural, it's such a similar mindset. It's very, very isolating. It requires a ton of discipline, and it requires you to have a few screws loose, I think. I don't know. I just think writers and swimmers are so similar that I'm surprised that we don't hear there's more novels out there that spent their lives with their heads stuck in chlorine for so many waking hours.
Yeah, you're right. I've actually never made that parallel myself before, but there is that isolation. And there's also, when things are going well, there's a great pacing and rhythm, which is always a great feeling in swimming or in writing.
Yeah, it's like this this muscle memory that you know, I remember when I was swimming, even 2 days out of the water, you get back in and just feel terrible and feel like your body wasn't reacting the right way. And it's the same kind of thing when a draft is really moving and you take a day or two off. It's, I mean, it can throw the whole project. And it's an odd thing, but the muscle memory is such a real sensation, whether you're in front of a keyboard or in water. It really does matter.
Yeah. So tell us how you incorporated the swimming theme into the book and why you wanted to do that in this particular story.
Well, it's with the character, swimming in the water is just such a core part of my own identity that when I was creating this character, this series character, you know, I certainly didn't want him in my own likeness in every way at all, but I did like the thought of him having been a swimmer with some degree of promise. But you know, at that impressionable age of 12 or 13 years old, that's when an awful lot of talent kind of just falls by the wayside, and a lot of times it's from just natural temptation for teenagers. But I like the thought of my character really having a very good reason to have fallen off this virtuous Olympic path, and that reason was because his family imploded, so that, you know, it just wasn't going to happen anymore.
Right. Publishers Weekly says Olympic swimmer Barrett dives into the disturbing side of competitive sport. So tell us a little bit about that darker side.
I just, that's where I'm my imagination is really drawn. Having spent a lot of years working for NBC Olympics and doing Olympic writing after I finished competing, I found myself quite frustrated at kind of being an inspiration salesman, so to speak, and just always selling the virtues and the positivity and the hard work and the blah, 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 aren't these, you know, these great examples, because that's really not the way I saw it or I remembered it. I really, you know, I just remember a lot of the darkness and a lot of the demons that come up. There's the huge problems with sexual abuse in the sport between coaches and athletes, and there's also just huge issues with mental health and depression. I think the Olympic Village is one of the saddest places you'll ever see or ever you could ever be, because it's just a massive identity crisis after people finish competing, and they're just lost and lurching around, behaving poorly and making bad decisions. And I just remember from 2016 Ryan Lochte having all that bad press and acting like a fool, but I found it quite relatable, not his actions, but the fact that he's just this lost guy, that your identity has been snatched away from you the minute you finish competing. So it's not just the really dark stuff like the sexual abuse. It's the mental illness and the depression stuff that comes with that high end of sport that really fascinates me.
Yeah, I totally can understand that. I didn't experience myself, but I can totally see that, because they're so dedicated to what they're doing, and then, you know, no matter what success they've had, it's like, what now? Nothing, kind of, you know, they've got to really search hard to find something to take that place.
Yeah, and a lot of times what takes the place is not the healthiest decisions. It's, you know, impulse control becomes pretty poor when, you know, when all of a sudden you feel like your identity's been temporarily slashed away.
Yeah. So I'd like to, this is the third book, as I said, so I'd like to ask you as a writer how you feel you've evolved from book one through book three, what lessons you've taken away from writing book one, book two, and then into book three, and how you feel you've changed as a writer.
I think the biggest thing for me is the research and the homework and the reporting has changed and evolved so much. The first one in particular wasn't from first personal experience in that sense, but it just was such it didn't require very much research on my part at all. It just flowed from personal understanding, so to speak. But as the series has evolved, this one in particular, it was a joy to write, because it required really, you know, my degrees in journalism, and it required a good deal of reporting and getting out there and learning about the real estate and the construction of these super talls on Billionaire's Row, and learning about just the really high-end criminality of the pharmaceutical industry. There's a big storyline about the sale of painkillers at the very, very highest level in this book, and I feel like that couldn't be more relevant after reading about, you know, just the last couple of days with the Purdue Pharma fines and the Johnson & Johnson fines. This is stuff that is happening right now, and if you're paying attention and reading the news and doing your homework, then a writer should be able to take this into fiction.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point because I remember, do you remember Jeffrey Archer? He's an older writer. I don't know if he still writes, but he wrote one about Wall Street. And when I actually took my stockbroker's license a number of years ago. And when I was taking it, I thought, oh boy, his book was like right on. Because when I read it, I thought, oh, here's fiction. But I think if we can carry real life into fiction, it opens the doors and opens people's eyes to things they normally wouldn't experience.
I fully agree with that. And I think to take it to another degree, the struggles of long-form journalism and magazines and newspapers has been really well documented. But I think if you look at fiction as taking that storytelling that is going away to an alarming degree, I think novelists and particularly crime novelists have a responsibility to be taking up those stories, because you're not finding these big investigative pieces because journalism isn't funding it any longer. So it's the place you can really get that reporting sometimes is fiction these days.
Yeah. So after the Olympics, you mentioned you did a lot of writing about the Olympics for NBC. I mean, you've done exceptionally well. Again, in that, you won 3 Emmys, a Peabody Award for your work on NBC's Olympic broadcasts. Was then becoming an author the next natural step? At what point did you decide, hey, I want to write fiction?
There was never a point down the line. It was always the first goal above all. But it was like that same way with swimming. It was never about pursuing it for some financial reward or some weird twisted thing where the goal was always first and foremost to be able to write fiction on my own terms. And it took a lot longer than I would have liked or would have expected to get into print. My first novel was published when I was 42. So I certainly expected that to happen sooner, but it happens at the pace that it's meant to happen. So writing fiction was always the number one goal. It just took longer than I would have liked.
But those daily practices and those misses eventually turn you into a quote overnight success, right?
Yeah, that term is oftentimes total nonsense. I remember the book. Do you remember the Noah Hawley book Before the Fall that was the big sensation a few years ago?
Right, right.
He was called the overnight success, and he was just everywhere all of a sudden. And I read an interview with him saying, well, I did publish 3 novels 20 years ago. Nobody bought them, and I've been writing trying to write fiction since he was in college. And now he's 50, and he's like, well, I guess you can call me overnight, but nothing could be further from the truth.
Right. That kind of happened with John Grisham, too, because they went back and republished his very first novel, which nobody really paid any attention to once he became famous. And David Baldacci said, yeah, I'm an overnight success. It just took 20 years to get there.
It's so true of so many people, and I mean it's great to be able to say that laughing, because there's an awful lot of folks that are waiting to be that overnight success and writing book after book.
Right. So is there a certain type of scene that you enjoy writing, Casey, and is there a certain type of scene that is a struggle for you?
Yes, to both. I mean this may sound a little bit funny for someone that hasn't spent years in Manhattan, but I love writing about real estate. I'm such a real estate junkie that I read all these listings of triple mint. This room is described as this and this, and I love that. I don't know what weird thing it gets into New Yorkers' heads about looking at these real things. But I love describing architecture and real estate and rooms and details and design. I get a huge kick out of that. And the hardest thing for me is the third act. I feel pretty strong with characterization and description and sentence to sentence stuff. Where I don't feel as confident is my third act plotting. And that's something that it's a muscle that I got to work on. I think that's my thing that I've identified that I really want to improve. That's where I find the biggest challenge.
I want to ask you about prologue, because I always read prologues. They're part of the story. Oh gosh, about 10 years ago or so, I was part of a writer's group and they were talking about prologue, and they were all, no, never write a prologue. And I'm like, why? And they said, nobody ever reads them. I've always read them. And you have one in your book. So talk to us about Prologue and why you set it up that way.
I've heard the exact same thing. I've had this discussion with my agent before over beers, and he even on his social media will say, and he'll put out, I'm reading submissions or whatever, and I trust his taste just implicitly. I think he's so spot on with all his insights, and he's put out there, don't send me a prologue. I won't read them. And every book I've published has a prologue. The first one was one page, the second one was two pages, the next one is four pages. So my prologue seemed to be getting longer, and he doesn't seem to mind. And I love setting a scene that way, and I especially if you're writing a full novel in the first person, it's nice to at least get out of that first person voice a little bit at the beginning and maybe a little at the end. But yeah, I've heard that so many times. Nobody wants to read a prologue. What are you doing? But I don't know. I can't resist, and I love when I see prologues, and especially in crime fiction.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I like I said, I've always it's part of the story to me. So I've never had an issue with them at all. I want to talk about I want to talk about dialogue, and because that can make or break a book. How do you write dialogue? Your dialogue flows very smoothly, very naturally, not true of all books. So how do you go about writing dialogue?
Well, thank you for that. I think the biggest thing for me was the time I spent writing for broadcasters in television. Where you kind of have to just get into their cadences. Sometimes before I would write for somebody new, I would just pull up YouTubes of them on Good Morning America or whatever. I'm talking about very, very simple stuff, but just listening for little verbal tics and little hesitations and teaching yourself to hear that and hopefully bringing that into fiction. But when I look at the years I spent writing for television, I think there was a lot of stuff that maybe wasn't great to learn. There's a lot of bad habits to unlearn, but I think the most valuable thing I picked up was actually listening to somebody's voice, listening to a broadcaster's voice, and picking up what makes that voice unique, and then inserting it into the script.
Yeah, absolutely. And that tempo, and as you said, that tick. How important is your writing space? Some people can write jogging along on the bus, on the back of the bus, and others have got to have circumstances just right. How does that work for you?
Well, right now I'm actually standing in my beloved little writing space. It's a nook in our cottage in the Catskills that I've carved out as my tiny little library. It's tiny. It could maybe fit a twin bed and a desk and nothing else, and it's my perfect place to write, which is a dream to be able to work in this space. But I live full-time in the city. I'm only in the Catskills maybe 100 days a year at the best year. But in the city, it's trickier. My favorite spaces in the city to write are, I like being in cafes that are mostly empty. I don't like the presence of other laptops. I don't know why. My favorite thing is to be in a space where people aren't speaking English, where the other diners are speaking a different language. Because I like to hear the ambient noise, but I don't want to understand and overhear a conversation.
I can understand that too, because somebody once said to me when we were actually in Mexico, so obviously they were speaking another language, and I was writing away, and they were like, how can you do that with, and I said, because I can't understand what they're saying. So there's rhythm there and pace and everything, but it's not distracting to me.
Yeah, it's not but personally I find music, I wish I could listen to music while I was working. I know friends and writers that will always have their headphones on and have kind of a playlist while they're working. I can't do it. It just distracts me too much. But if I hear just conversation in a language that I can't possibly understand, that to me is perfect.
Yeah, interesting. I want to ask you what a couple of words mean to you. And you are definitely familiar with the first one from your swimming career and your writing with NBC and, of course, writing as an author. The first word is discipline. What does that mean to you?
Daily. Just a daily commitment.
What does creativity mean to you?
Curiosity, humor.
Spontaneity,
this conversation.
And how do you define success for yourself?
Just being able to finish, to whatever it is. Like there's so many smart people I know that you have all these great ideas but don't finish them and don't ultimately execute it. So to me, success is just a matter of finishing whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. So you said your success, you wrote your first book when you were, I think, 42, you said. What do you know now that you wish you'd known back when you were 22?
I wish I hadn't been in such a rush. I don't know if all writers feel this, but I think there's a... I put such stock in the writers that had this big breakout first book. And I think of, like, Bret Easton Ellis, Jay McInerney's Less Than Zero, or going back to Fitzgerald's Lost in Paradise. And I put such stock and such envy in those writers. And I really beat myself up over it, where, you know, comparing yourself to someone that had the breakout with their very first shot is really an unhealthy thing, and it's not terribly realistic. And a lot of times it's not great for your longer writing career. So that's what I wish I had known. Just, you know, give yourself a break and let the pace come to you.
Yeah. And what's your favorite thing and your least favorite thing about writing?
The feeling you get after a day where you know you've gotten good words down. Say a day where you put down 2,000 words and you know they're right and you know they're strong and the story's moving. That's the best part.
Yeah. What's the worst part for you?
The days that aren't like that.
I know for many people it's actually getting my butt in the chair, because I'll do anything to avoid getting my butt in the chair.
Yeah, and I mean also actually the even worse, the ones that aren't like that are the ones where you, like, you know you have like ideas ready to go and you're ready to get in the chair and whatever it is, like, prevents it from happening, and then feeling it, you know, maybe slip away, or maybe that creative energy isn't there the next time. That can be just infuriating, just trying to tap it again.
Right. So before I let you go, I have to ask you where the name Duck Dolly came from. I mean, how important are names to you in the book? You said that Cassandra Kimball was, the Kimball part was a nod to someone else. So how important are names to you in your storytelling, and where did Duck Dolly come from?
It's probably evident to anyone that read my first book that I have a bit of alliteration sickness when it comes to names. Love alliterated names. But with Duck, it, you know, his given name was Lawrence Darley, and I think he was very, very happy not to have a nickname because the shame of his father's name. But Duck came about because I feel like as swimmers, people associate us as athletes, but we're not really athletes. Some swimmers are, but for the most part, like, you're water athletes, but you're mostly uncoordinated and really clumsy on land. And I had friends growing up that always would walk like ducks and would kind of waddle, particularly breaststrokers. They kind of waddle with their heels in and their toes out.
Yes.
Your little walk. So I envisioned him walking like that, and as a young swimmer he may have had that waddle, and hence the nickname.
That's interesting. I can see that now. I never really thought about that before. I know somebody who did butterfly and developed like massive shoulders, and they kind of walked like an ape, if I'm being honest. So,
yeah, you might have been talking about me about 20 years ago. Kind of what happened with me.
Well, it's been such fun talking with you, Casey. The book that is the third in the Duck Dolly series is called The Tower of Songs. I know listeners can find out more about you at your website. It's caseybarrettbooks.com, correct?
Correct. It's been a real pleasure talking to you as well. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. A final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I just hope you enjoy reading, and I hope you love reading crime fiction as much as I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.